What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Somalia has been called the failed state of all failed states. It's dirt poor, chaotic, overrun with guns, and hasn't had a real government in 15 years. Now, Islamists with reported ties to Al-Qaeda are taking over, partly in response to a reportedly botched CIA intervention. Osama bin Laden is celebrating. This hour, On Point, trouble in Somalia and fears of growing, not shrinking, turf for Al-Qaeda. You can join the conversation. What can we learn from Somalia about the U.S. war on terror? Is Al-Qaeda's area of opportunity shrinking or growing? Is our Black Hawk down again in Africa? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Nairobi, Kenya, is Rob Crilly. He's a freelance reporter with the Christian Science Monitor, the Times of London, and USA Today. He was in Mogadishu just last month. Rob Crilly, thanks for joining us. What is the latest in Mogadishu? Are the Islamists now fully in charge? Hello, Rob, can you tell us...
Sorry, I'm struggling to hear you a little bit. I wonder if you could just repeat the question, please.
Yes, I'm happy to, Rob. We know there's been a lot of fighting in the last couple of days in Mogadishu. Are the Islamists now fully in charge in the capital of Somalia?
Well, I think people are now sort of saying they control 99.9% of Mogadishu. They've succeeded in ousting the last of the warlords who is holed up in his fortified compound there. 500 of his fighters have surrendered and gone over to the Islamic court side. And I had reports last night that this last warlord had been captured by the Islamists, but he may have gone to ground, he may have disappeared off. And there still remain one or two small isolated pockets of fighters who may have connections to the warlords or other military strongmen in Mogadishu. But these are isolated small pockets. I think we can expect to see the Islamists move against these pockets in the next few days. So I think they are effectively in control of the city, but there are just one or two small pockets left.
Rob, you were in Mogadishu just last month. Give us a sense of the situation there and the power dynamic. What sparked this power struggle? What brought it to a head between the rather more secular warlords and the Islamic courts?
Yeah, the city last month when I visited was calm. It was peaceful. There weren't guns on the streets. I mean, Mogadishu is probably the second most dangerous city on the planet after Baghdad, but there was a sense of calm and a sense of safety while I was there. And that was in the immediate aftermath of the Islamists taking control. Now, since then, I think a number of splits have emerged within the movement. When I was there, it was very much the moderates who were in control. Sheikh Sharif Ahmed was the chairman of the Islamic courts, and he was certainly saying he was only interested in getting the hated warlords out of Mogadishu. He had no plan for the rest of Somalia. But since then, we've seen a number of other characters come to the fore. Sheikh Awais, who is viewed by the US as a terrorist, he's now in charge of the Islamic courts. And what we seem to be seeing is that as the Islamic courts have moved out across Somalia, they have taken control of a series of more towns, and they have introduced Sharia law as they have gone. And a number of their key backers within Mogadishu, the businessmen who were providing money for the Islamic courts because they were bringing a degree of law and order to the city, a number of them are becoming rather enchanted with the Islamic courts. They don't like the extremist turn that the movement has taken. So I think there are one or two splits emerging within the Islamic courts movements. And that may be why we have seen one or two flare-ups in the past couple of weeks. We saw a Swedish cameraman shot dead in Mogadishu about 2 weeks ago. And it may be that the Islamic courts are just struggling a little bit to keep everybody together and everybody on board. So while there was a feeling of peace and security there a month ago, I think obviously residents there will tell you for the past couple of days in particular there's been a lot of fighting and things are not perhaps as stable as they were.
You're describing the Islamic courts, who apparently have stepped into a breach of order there to bring some kind of justice. Of course, they have an armed element in their militia. They're being described in some quarters as a kind of counterpart or equivalent of the Afghan Taliban in Somalia. Does that look fair to you, Rob Crilly?
Well, a month ago, I think I would have said it was fair. I met a lot of Somalis who are keen to say that they were moderate Muslims, and the Islamic courts, their only real purpose was to kick out the warlords who kept the city in a state of anarchy for 15 years. I think speaking to some Somali friends of mine in Nairobi who are very much of that opinion, that the Islamic courts were not a threat, they weren't anything sinister. A number of them have actually changed their tune just in the past few days, and they're extremely worried about the way that the extremists have come to the fore in this movement. So I don't know. I would steer away from that a little bit at the moment, because I think if we try and label them the new Taliban, the African Taliban, there's a danger that we play in extremist hands. We weaken the moderates who are trying to put on a rather more acceptable face. And I think we strengthen the hands of the extremists who want to point to the West and say, the West hates us because we're Muslims. I think we need to be a little bit careful, but certainly people I'm speaking to are rather concerned about the twist that we've seen in the past couple of weeks.
And Rob, what about among Somalis, the connection between the Americans, the CIA reportedly, and the warlords? Do Somalis see that as a fact? It's widely reported in the Western press. Do Somalis see the CIA as having, especially recently, having been behind the warlords?
Yeah, well, I was in Baidoa recently as well, where I met members of the transitional government who have almost no power, who are sitting there. And they are extremely angry that the CIA in the US has been reportedly backing the warlords. They feel they've got a legitimate government. They were building a form of peace in Somalia, and they feel they were totally undermined. All their efforts have been undermined by the US backing another section of society in Mogadishu. And certainly within Mogadishu, I met a number of people who said they were very disappointed the international community had decided to back the warlords. And a number of them said their support for the Islamic courts had actually been strengthened by that. They were rather ambivalent to the Islamic courts before these allegations emerged. And once they were aware that, once again, as they saw it, American interests were backing one side, many Somalis I spoke to felt that they no longer had any sympathy for the warlords. The warlords were never liked, but this was sort of the final straw for many people in actually pushing them over to the Islamic cause. And I met a number of people on the streets of Mogadishu who said that. Yeah. Although I would just caution, you have to take these words with a slight pinch of salt, as I suspect some people would have been slightly afraid of suggesting that they didn't support the Islamic courts.
Rob Crilly in Nairobi, Kenya, recently out of Mogadishu, a freelance reporter there. Rob, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Joining me now from Washington, John Prendergast, a senior advisor at the International Crisis Group. He's worked in the White House and State Department in the Clinton administration from 1996 to 2001, has spent a lot of time in Africa and in Somalia, has written 7 books on the continent, many trips to Somalia and Mogadishu. John Prendergast, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Can you boil this down for us? What has happened in the last 6 months in Somalia to bring us to this strange pass of open fighting in the streets and now an Islamist rule in Mogadishu and more?
Well, after a decade and a half of what the closest probably condition of pure anarchy in the entire world, the only country without a government, Somalia finally has had a sort of cataclysmic political change in its environment because of this dramatic consolidation of power by the Islamic courts since June, largely a result of the acceleration of that process, largely as a result of the United States' support for this coalition of warlords that Rob talked about, that the United States, that the Central Intelligence Agency was funding. So I think we've had now a dramatic reversal in the course of Somali history, in the sense that rather than the continuing breakdown of social order divisions between and among clans that had marked the last decade and a half since the dictator Siad Barre was overthrown in 1991, sparking that massive civil war and the intervention by the United States and the UN. I think we now have a process of reconsolidation in larger blocks, one of the blocks being the Islamic courts, the other block slowly in formation being the warlords who have been defeated, aligning themselves with this transitional government that was established last year, but not even based in the capital, which has very control over very little territory, but yet is a political entity that has some juice. So we have now the potential, instead of a bunch of mice running around biting each other, we have the potential of two elephants squaring off. With potentially disastrous consequences.
This presumably is not what Washington wanted. Why did the CIA suddenly get involved, and why did it go this way? They must have wanted something quite different.
Well, it was a slow process. You know, the U.S., in the aftermath of the bombings in 1998 of the United States embassies in Tanzania and Kenya, which was sort of one of al-Qaeda's first very, very public strikes directly against the United States and its interests. I think since then, U.S. policy over two administrations, three, if you count both Bushes, has followed and attempted to try to find a way to address what is perceived to be an intelligence black hole in Somalia, where al-Qaeda figures were going in and out, planning operations, moving weapons, and really just generally doing things that we simply didn't have a very good fix on. So there have been various sporadic efforts to try to do something about trying to create some kind of a partner in Somalia that could help with the larger counterterrorism objectives. It was only 2002 and the 2003 when the Bush administration decided to get more directly involved, roll up its sleeves, and start providing direct support to individual militia leaders who the Bush administration thought could secure our interests by keeping an eye on some of these actors as they came in and out of Somalia and potentially capturing them through military operations or killing them if they had the chance.
John, hold the thought right there. We've got to take a short break here. We want to understand how this unfolded. We're talking about an American intervention in Somalia and fears of a new Taliban in the Horn of Africa there. You can join us, 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Funding for On Point comes in part from Loomis Sayles, researching and investing for pension funds, foundations, and individuals for more than 80 years, with a sincere commitment to giving back to the community. LoomisSayles.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about an American intervention in Somalia and fears of a new Taliban and spreading al-Qaeda influence in the Horn of Africa. The very end of last month, Osama bin Laden himself suddenly appeared, talking about Musab al-Zarqawi's death, the Lion of the Holy War, he called him, but also about Somalia. Let's listen to a bit of that. Bin Laden talking on in a tape released on June 30th. He says, among other things, we will continue, God willing, to fight you and your allies everywhere, in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Somalia and Sudan, until we waste all your money and kill your men. You can join the conversation today. What do you think? Look at Somalia. Is this Black Hawk Down without the choppers, a CIA intervention handing Somalia to the Islamists? And are we seeing new al-Qaeda opportunities from Afghanistan to Africa? Could the war on terror be handing bin Laden his Islamic empire, his caliphate? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We've been talking with John Prendergast. He's senior advisor at the International Crisis Group, longtime observer of Somalia. I'm joined in the studio now as well by Stephen Van Ivra. He's professor of political science at MIT, member of the MIT Security Studies Program. Stephen Van Ivra, thanks for being here.
Welcome.
We're going to get more detail from John on exactly what happened here, but we can't help looking at the big map. Donald Rumsfeld in Afghanistan today saying the Taliban's not going to win, but he and Karzai saying, yes, they are having some successes right now. We see what's going on in Iraq. Now, here we are all the way in the Horn of Africa. Rob Crilly in Nairobi reminds us, you know, to hold your horses here. This isn't exactly the Taliban in charge yet, but it's taken a turn in that direction. Do we see al-Qaeda's influence not shrinking under the pressure of the war on terror, but potentially growing?
Yes, I think we do. Al-Qaeda thrives on sanctuaries and civil wars. We know that they built the whole organization up in the 1990s in Afghanistan, where they had a sanctuary that was so secure they could build infrastructure and bases and training facilities, and they milled several tens of thousands of people through their facility. And that's how they became such a strong worldwide force, and that's why how they built an organization that had such strong esprit de corps. So to defeat them, the world has to deny them sanctuary. And what we see going on around the Muslim world is backsliding. We see that Afghanistan is going the wrong way, and increasingly we see their friends, the Taliban, have free run of the southern and eastern part of the country, and they're fighting in larger and larger groups. Mm. We see in Iraq they've got a new playground in the Sunni land. We see in Somalia, as we're hearing here, that they've opened up a new friendly place. Somalia has been a possibility for them for a long time, but it's looking more and more ripe for them. And we see in northwest Pakistan that the Pakistani government still has not established security in their northwest frontier province, which is where bin Laden and al-Zawahiri are probably mm-hmm. hiding. So we are failing completely at a central project in the war on al-Qaeda, which is to shut down al-Qaeda sanctuaries.
John Prendergast, take us deeper into how this happened in Somalia. Surely Washington wanted to deny access to Islamist radicals there, not open it up. When did the CIA move in with most recently? What sort of precipitated the flurry of activity in these last few months, and how did it go wrong? What were the debates in Washington about it? We see someone, the top guy in the State Department on Somalia, as I read it here, sent packing off to Chad because he objected. What happened here?
Well, it's first of all, just 30 seconds, over a decade, the Islamic courts had been slowly and organically establishing themselves in different parts of Mogadishu, very much building on clan alliances that focused on the provision of security. I think if you were to do a poll of walking down the street informally or with a Madison Avenue firm that went in there and mm-hmm. pulled every Somali, you'd find 100% of Somalis seeking security as their first priority.
John, let me just ask you about that, if I may. You say the Islamic courts. Now, I was in Mogadishu a decade ago, visited one of these courts. It was an awfully humble affair at that time. It didn't look like anything like, you know, the sort of organ of state. Have they grown? Do they have armed militia around the city now, or is it literally just a judiciary?
Basically, what it is, what these courts are, the courts that have aligned themselves, the Islamist courts, they basically provide that courtroom that doles out law and order, that doles out justice on every kind of affair imaginable in the territory which it serves, and it provides a mechanism for the redistribution of income through the alms that are given by more wealthy Somalis, particularly the businessmen that support the courts, and they provide social services. Now, you're talking about an environment, again, of anarchy, mm-hmm. a vacuum of statelessness, where no government has been there for 15 years. The government that preceded it did nothing for its people, and the warlords that controlled the patchwork territory throughout the city and the surrounding countryside did nothing for the population but terrorize them and conduct predatory, parasitic operations like taxation and roadblocks and those kinds of things. So these guys come in, they provide security, they provide resources, they provide welfare, social welfare for the people. It's, you know, I mean, it's attractive.
So what precipitated this turnover in the recent months?
I think that the concern on the part of the Islamic courts coalition was that as the United States was providing more assistance to this warlord alliance in the name of counterterrorism, that it would get stronger, the alliance the U.S. was backing, and potentially attack them. So I think they decided to preemptively attack and move before this warlord coalition had the chance to do so. So in fact, their planning, their effort, the desire was to consolidate control of Mogadishu over the next few years. The fear that if they waited to do so, they would lose their opportunity led them to strike more quickly than they expected, and their military operation was successful much more quickly than they expected.
Now, we read about the CIA flying in from Nairobi with bundles of cash for warlords, but were they really going after the Islamists, or were they just trying to root out al-Qaeda in Somalia?
Well, I think for most of the time, over the last few years that these payments were ongoing. The objective was sort of the fantasy of the laser strike, that we could just pay these guys, ignore the environment in which they were in, ignore what they represent to most Somalis, which is the problem, not the solution, and would have no impact, no negative consequence, unintended consequences, et cetera, and we would just be able to capture a few al-Qaeda suspects. Well, that fantasy, as most do, didn't come true. And so what happened was it ended up strengthening the resolve of the courts to consolidate their control and expand their territory, and it hastened the military action that the Islamic courts undertook in order to consolidate the control of Mogadishu.
You write the State Department has had just one full-time political officer working on Somalia. He got transferred out. What was the debate in Washington?
Well, it's remarkable. You know, you have a national security strategy that is a blueprint, you know, for undertaking counterterrorism operations holistically, to invest in governance, to build up social service capacity, to do the kind of hearts and minds campaign that is necessary to really root out terrorism. And they threw that manual out the window, the Bush administration did, when they started to construct their policy on Somalia. So we did nothing to address the causes of a lot of the problems in Somalia and ignored Somali problems, so we alienated a vast percentage of Somalia's population by providing assistance to the very people that were creating the problem.
You write that Somalia is an al-Qaeda recruiter's dream. But as I know Somalia, it has not exactly been the most radical Islamist hotbed. A lot of secular sentiment there at the same time. A lot of these warlords don't seem up for this. Is this a new kind of Taliban-style playground, really? Or is there a self-governing aspect to Somali politics and culture here?
There's no question moderation is the norm for Somalis, but, you know, it's usually not the vast majority of people that participate in these kinds of actions. You know, young Somalis will turn to these groups for money, and occasionally because of a shared ideology. They've been coming up now. The only educational opportunities anymore are through the Quranic schools, and in some of those schools, particularly in the areas where the courts control, there is a radical stream of education there that presses people and re-educates them about the world. And so there's certainly they're graduating large numbers of students. They're speaking Arabic instead of Somali and learning Arabic, and they really have no prospect of meaningful work. You have all kinds of recruitment going on. So I think that, you know, it doesn't require the vast majority of Somalis to be supportive for these guys to be able to continue to expand the size of their militias and their military reach as they begin to expand control of different parts of southern Somalia.
Stephen Van Evere, with me in the studio, sees a kind of fundamental flaw in our approach to the war on terror that may have led to this. Do you see that? And do you see, I mean, here's Bin Laden in his tape kind of celebrating what looks like an expansion of reach. Do you see a growing al-Qaeda opportunity here and a flaw in U.S. policy opening the way for that?
Yeah, the opportunity for al-Qaeda is certainly there and growing. I mean, they have been able to, the cell that operates along the eastern seaboard of the Indian Ocean, along Kenyan coasts and Somali coast, certainly has a better opportunity now to find the sanctuary that Stephen was talking about that is so crucial to expansion. And so now that the warlords that the U.S. was associated with have been knocked out of Mogadishu, they have a larger playground into which to operate and some sympathetic elements. It's like the Taliban in the sense that, at this point, in the sense that they're not exporters of terrorism, the Islamic courts. They're not terrorists themselves, I don't believe. But they are providing, as Stephen said, that sanctuary. At least a few of the courts in the larger coalition are providing sanctuary for individuals who have been directly associated with terrorist activities, past terrorist bombings. And so I think that that potential of increasing territory and increasing support for sanctuary for al-Qaeda elements is really the thing to fear at this juncture.
I want to begin to turn to our listeners. Lidwin is calling from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Hi, Lidwin, you're on the air.
Yes, I am. How are you? How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Lidwin?
You know, I would like to really support John Prendergast on his analysis about what happened in Mogadishu, but I'd like to add two things.
Yes.
I would agree with him in my outrage that the U.S. government, with our tax money, initially helped a process, however flawed, that brought into being a federal government, a transitional federal government. It is a government that was put together by warlords, but it is, I believe, the only hope we have for a state in Somalia.
So you're saying the U.S. was right to get involved in that way?
Right to get involved, but then they turn around and they undermine that very federal government, which is sitting in Baidaba, by supporting the Mogadishu warlords. Right, and because, as I think Prendergast said, they hope for some laser operation that would take out some Al-Qaeda people who might be hiding there. So I think nobody really at this moment talks about the transitional federal government, which has more support in Somalia, as far as we can see. By the way, I don't mean your speakers, but in general the media. However flawed, it's the only legitimate process we have. It's the only legitimate framework we have.
But right now, you've got the Islamic courts running Mogadishu and seeming to build their own kind of legitimacy there just by being there and doing their work.
Well, but nobody has mentioned, even John, although he has done it in some of his other work, is that the people who call themselves the courts are a small, relatively small group of people that have been fighting over Mogadishu since 1991. They have failed to unify Somalis around this hardline Islam for 15 years, but they have been able to organize and to unify two subsections of a clan.
And now they've got control of Mogadishu, so they're a call to support the interim government and kind of a ray of hope there that a lot of Somalis may not want to go this Islamist way, yet that's the crowd that's got Mogadishu right now. Lidwin, thanks for calling. Let me take a call from Northampton, Massachusetts. Guy's on the line. Hi, Guy. You're on the air.
Hello. Yes. I was wondering, we're hearing a lot of mention of the CIA involvement in supporting these warlords, and if we just reel back a little bit, there was a great deal of talk about Iraq, after the non-discovery of weapons of mass destruction,
yes,
that in fact it was the CIA who gave the administration misinformation. That's the line we heard from the government.
Okay.
And, of course, in retrospect, there's a lot of debate about whether the CIA was pressured and that this was policy to force to create an image of a
right.
policy.
So where are you going with that, Guy?
Well, what I'm going with this is I'm wondering now if the CIA is deliberately being given a black eye in this case for failing in supporting the warlords. So as to protect a bad administration policy decision.
Let's ask our guest, John Prendergast, first to you, the sort of core impetus for this intervention and the way it apparently went awry. Does the CIA own that, or does it live somewhere else?
Well, I mean, the CIA does not. I worked in the White House for a few years and did the principals meetings in the Situation Room. The CIA never decides anything on its own. It never goes operational on its own. These are decisions made by the United States government and in coordination by the National Security Council, and the National Security Advisor at the time was Condoleezza Rice. So this is a decision that's wholly owned by the Bush administration and implemented by the CIA. So when we shorthand and say the CIA provided resources, Guy is right to at least point out it would be completely inappropriate to say that the CIA was undertaking some kind of rogue operation that was or undermining what our larger counterterrorism interests. That's crazy. It was definitely a Bush administration policy with one hand on the wheel and not really looking at the road, because this is backwater, peripheral zone of the world that we didn't really feel like we had to invest much effort into, and it bit us in the lip, because of our eyes being off the road.
A backwater, but Bin Laden might be happy to have it. Stephen Van Ever, do you see a link here between this apparent fumble and the overall shape of U.S. policy, counterterrorism policy of late? I mean, is there some linkage between this failure and our posture?
Yeah, I think our failure in Somalia reflects some chronic blind spots in the way the Bush administration has thought about the war on terror. Number one, they tend reflexively to define the Al-Qaeda problem as a problem of state-sponsored terror. They are dubious that terrorists can be dangerous. They don't have state sponsorship, and therefore they're dubious that failed states really pose a serious danger, because a failed state is in the state. And
even after the example of Afghanistan?
Well, yeah. This is a chronic stream of thought you see in the administration. States, terror can't really generate the muscle to harm America unless it's got a state behind it.
But Somalia's got a lot of turf. That's placed for camps, for recruits, for recuperation, for hiding fugitives.
But it doesn't have a hostile government. This is how the administration tends to define the problem. Let's look for hostile governments. Let's look for Saddam, for the Iranians, for the Syrians. Let's muscle them around. Let's move them out. That's the problem, and that's the way you fight the war. I also think the administration has two other blind spots. One is they tend to be attracted to military solutions. Mm-hmm. Force is the answer. They don't like more, sissy stuff like state building, peacemaking, arbitrating agreements between factions so you can create a government in Mogadishu, this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. State building is for sissies. And they like to do things on the cheap. They've been trying again and again to show that they can solve this terror problem without spending much money. They've
Stephen Van Ever, stand by for a moment. John Prendergast in Washington. We're talking about Somalia and fears of a new Taliban there. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And RHR International, an executive and organizational development firm committed to integrating executives into new roles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a bobbled American intervention in Somalia and fears of a new Taliban and spreading al-Qaeda influence in the Horn of Africa. You can join the conversation. What does this whole story say about U.S. counterterrorism policy? Are we doing terror war on the cheap, handing out cash to warlords and failing? And what would be a better way? Do we really want to be nation-building in countries like Somalia? Do we have to? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. I've been joined in the studio today by Stephen Van Ever, a political science professor at MIT, member of the Security Studies program there, and from Washington by John Prendergast, senior advisor at the International Crisis Group with deep experience in Africa and Somalia. Callers on the line right now, Ahmed from Nashville, Tennessee. Ahmed, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me. The timing that the CIA, bore money to the warlords was it was not the right time to intervene, because those warlords, they were a member of the coalition government that they built in Nairobi. So, they abandoned the government, and the people, the Somali people, were seeing those warlords as hijackers who hijacked everything. So by the time that the people find out that the CIA is supporting those groups, the Islamic court get an opportunity to get the hearts and minds of the people.
So the U.S. became allied with a group that you're saying most Somali people were not too happy with.
No, the Somali people were not happy with, intervention of the CIA supporting the warlords, because the people... Not only the people, even the transitional government was looking at them as a...
And now those are the American allies, and they haven't won. Ahmed, thanks for your call. Let's get another from Newton, Massachusetts. Catherine's on the air. Hi, Catherine.
Yes, hello. My question had to do with what authority the Bush administration was claiming in allowing the CIA to intervene in Somalia, where it's not seeking intelligence, in quotes, but rather covert intervention to change the course of events in a foreign country. And I'd just like to connect this with what I see as the historic problem with the CIA, if we could just focus on that for a minute, and namely that in recent times, where reams of newsprint and ink and airtime was spent devoted to CIA reform, that never raised this question: shouldn't the CIA be limited to intelligence?
But Catherine, don't you assume that the CIA is now intervening, and don't you want it to, if it could intervene successfully to, let's say, go after al-Qaeda?
in a foreign country? No, because that is precisely the job of the United Nations, according to Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, a treaty to which we are obligated in the most serious way. It's the function of the Security Council to determine if a threat to the peace exists, and then to marshal the forces of its members to do something
to go after it. Well, let's see what's actually going on here. John Prendergast in Washington, what about authority here? Isn't this what the CIA is doing all over the place?
Yeah, well, I mean, the intention of the policy was not a bad one. The idea being that we need to gather intelligence about people that are dangerous, people have track records of actually attacking U.S. interests. And only recently do we see the policy sort of expand, as we used to call it, mission creep, to a more robust and comprehensive military engagement by the warlord coalition against the Islamic courts in Mogadishu. So it was the right intention, but they just picked the wrong actors. To go back to what Ahmed said, which is a perfect segue to what Catherine was just saying, the U.S. circumvented the very government it had just helped to create, picked out individual warlords, some of whom were actually ministers in the government, and promoted those individuals through cash payments to try to undertake this counterterrorism intelligence gathering and snatching operation, and simply re-empowered these warlords at the expense of, direct expense of, this fledgling transitional government, alienated the Islamic courts, alienated the Somali people, as Ahmed said, much more deeply than when necessary, basically just chose the wrong horses, just backed the wrong horses at a very sensitive juncture. And this is why it's blown up in our face.
Stephen Van Evero, what do you see coming here? I mean, I'm reading here in the Tallahassee newspaper, the Tallahassee Democrat, just Saturday morning, dawn Saturday, 40 Marine reservists from the Tallahassee area deployed to Djibouti, just around the corner there from Somalia in eastern Africa. Is a military response what's coming here? Is the United States really going to get involved in nation building in Somalia? We tried that. We got Black Hawk down and out with our tail between our legs more than a decade ago.
I think we've got to learn how to do nation building. And we don't want to, and it's hard work, and it takes a lot of money. It takes expertise. But the truth is, if you think the terror problem is with us for the long run, we've got to develop the expertise needed to prevent state implosion and failed states of the kind we saw in Somalia and Afghanistan.
Is there evidence we're doing that elsewhere? Rumsfeld is in Afghanistan right now. We've put a lot of effort into Afghanistan.
I don't think we have. I think we've tried to do Afghanistan on the cheap.
We've been there for almost 5 years.
Yeah, and trying to spend as little as we could. And if you go back and look at the record, you'll see that Karzai, after we went in 2002, Karzai begged us to lend him more security assistance and more economic assistance. And the view in Washington was, let's do this on the cheap. Let's keep the warlord system in place. Let's let the old order persist in this country where a bunch of warlords divide the place up and basically no central rule that amounts to much of anything. And that is how Taliban has made a comeback in that country.
John Prendergast, what about in Somalia? What's the opportunity or the chance there now? Are the Islamists in such power that the U.S. cannot come in and try and support the interim government? Do you really expect to see American, soldiers or Peace Corps or something in there doing nation building? How would that work?
Well, I mean, if you want people in other countries to care about your issues, and ours being predominantly counterterrorism now, you got to care about theirs. And I think, as Steve's saying, the sissy stuff, as you call it, Stephen, the state reconstruction is the bottom line for most Somalis. Is they perceive the United States as disinterested, as completely uninterested in the reconstruction of state authority in Somalia. That's where we have to engage now. We have to roll up our sleeves, get involved in the day-to-day diplomacy that's necessary to build the alliances and coalitions to create a true government of national unity. So what does that mean specifically? In operational diplomatic terms, that means to help support a process of dialogue and negotiation between the Islamic courts on the one hand and this transitional federal government on the other hand. And we need to be directly involved in that process and be seen to be involved in that process of supporting the objective of a government of national unity.
Jamie's calling from Boston. Hi, Jamie. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. Sure. I don't want to throw things off track because my comment deals with comments made much earlier in the show, but I just wanted to say that I think it's really dangerous every time something like this happens. People start throwing out the word anarchy, and I really think that the Islamist rule that's popping up here, it's really dangerous to create a linkage between that and a legitimate political movement in the U.S.
Well, it's being described here as a kind of answer to anarchy. People were desperate for somebody to bring order, and so some have accepted the Islamist courts, the Islamic
definitely,
courts.
Definitely, and that's definitely not a utopian system based on everybody being equal.
No, I'd say not, and maybe not justice as we'd like it. But John Prendergast, are you sympathetic with Somalis who turn to these courts because everything else has been chaotic?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the general feeling in the areas where the Islamic courts have risen up. People throw their support to them. Anyone from businessmen who are looking for some stability to undertake their commerce, to women who are trying to simply move from point A to point B to keep their families fed. To the young men who actually join the militias associated with the courts so that they can contribute positively to security. The kids who go to the schools that are run by these courts, I mean, it's just a widespread, in general terms, support for what the courts are providing to people now.
Well, could these then be our allies? Is the U.S. Rashly painting them as al-Qaeda in waiting? You know, might they actually be allies in building a stable society?
Well, in this basket of apples, there are a few rotten ones. And the rotten ones, there are a few courts that actually were providing sanctuary to al-Qaeda, that are providing sanctuary to al-Qaeda elements. And there are individuals, going back to one of the earlier callers' assertions, that have been for a long time leading attempts within Somalia to create an Islamist extremist organization. In the 90s, it was called Al-Ittihad. It was defeated by Ethiopia literally in a running war that took a couple of years in the northeast part and in the southwest part of the country. And so that there are very dangerous elements that are in the Islamic court coalition now, including the guy who's in charge, Hassan Dahir Owais. He has a history of very direct connections with al-Qaeda, so it's not something to be dismissed. So there, both things can be true. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, Somalis can crave the security and the social services these guys provide. On the other hand, they do provide sanctuary for elements that are a direct threat to the United States.
Abdi's calling from Baltimore. Hi, Abdi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, how you doing?
Hello.
I have a question, and I'm trying. Why is the United States government didn't want to help those Somalis who want to help themselves, such as Somaliland, and then use a prime example of those who really wanted to help and uplift their condition? The U.S. government and the international community will come to
that. Why didn't the U.S. government support Somalis who wanted to help themselves? Do you mean by that the interim government that we've heard about here?
Such as Somaliland.
Somaliland, okay.
And use an example of how people who want to help themselves and uplift the conditions that they live, the United States and the world community will come to their support.
Abdi, let's put that to John Prendergast. John, is the U.S. overlooking potential allies that might get us closer to stability for Somalis and security for the U.S.?
He's specifically referring, Abdi, to the northwest part of the country, which is... which people who live there refer to it as Somaliland, and most Somalis do. It is an entity that has attempted to create an independent state. It has undertaken democratic elections and has undertaken as well economic reform, economic policies that would largely be in line with what we promote through the IMF and the World Bank. So they're pretty much a model entity, authority, state authority in Africa for the kind of things the United States would like to support. The problem is, of course, that they've asserted independence, and that would upset the apple cart in Africa in terms of borders and the rest of it. So this is a big debate now within Africa as to whether or not, because of the colonial history, which had two separate colonies, the British Somaliland and
the Italian.
Italian Somalia, mm-hmm. Whether this warrants an independent state in the Northwest. And what we can do, as Abdi says, I think, is work much more closely with the authorities in Somaliland to build on their efforts to enhance stability in the region and promote economic development, but also to work more directly with them on counterterrorism initiatives, and that is important. You know, functional alliance building is something that we need to do much more of.
Mike's calling from New York City. Hi, Mike, you're on the air.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a point I'd like to make and a sort of question I'd like to pose to your speakers, but why does there seem to be such a fear of Islam in Somalia? Here you have these courts, which are trying to establish security, at least calmness as opposed to anarchy, and yet, America continuously, through CIA, supports these warlords who mean no good to the Somali people. And it seems reminiscent of, like, the Iran-Iraq war, funding Saddam over the table and Iran under the table. It appears to me that the U.S. may have some ideal of controlling these areas by promoting anarchy, as opposed to actually helping people.
So you look at the effect, and it looks like that, and then you go to motive. But I wonder, Mike, let us pick that up. Thanks for calling in from New York. Stephen Van Evero, Mike looks and says, wait a minute, why not work with these people? They're going to bring stability. But John Pendergast says, yes, but you've got some bad apples in here, some real sympathy with al-Qaeda in some quarters here. What's the big – is the U.S. going to have to ally with some Islamic radicals to make this work out ultimately? What's the big strategic vision you think is going to be required?
I think we ought to get about building up the central government in Somalia so that security can be provided by their government, not by the Islamists. I think the whole mess we've made here is a replay of what we did in Afghanistan in the 90s when the U.S. walked away from Afghanistan in 92, allowed the country to fall into chaos, and Afghans sought the help of the Taliban because that was the only way to secure themselves. What we should have done in Afghanistan in the 90s, from 92 to 96, was help establish order, broker peace among the factions, and create an Afghan government. That's what we should have done in Somalia over the last 15 years.
So what are the muscles we need to build up here to keep this kind of thing from happening again, to get things on a better track?
Well, I think there's three important state capacities that the U.S. government doesn't have today that it needs to develop to defeat al-Qaeda. One is the ability to prevent failed states and to rebuild them when they fail. We need state-building capacity. Right now, we don't have it. We don't have it. What we have is a huge Defense Department, sort of the DOD that ate Washington. Mm. And the functions that we need to build state capacity overseas don't exist, and we have to build them. Second, we have to build the capacity to make peace, which is very related to the problem of failed states, but should be distinguished. Al-Qaeda feeds on war. It loves the situation that John Prendergast was saying we're now teeing up in Somalia, where there could be a major conflict now between the Islamists and the coalition forming around the government. Al-Qaeda loves war. It's a great training ground for them. It's a networking opportunity. It's a great rallying cry, a bloody shirt to wave. They love war. They love the Kashmir War. They love the Chechen War. They love the war in Iraq.
One more, all the better.
Therefore, we need to develop the capacity to make peace abroad, to prevent war, and stop it when it happens. And right now, that's, again, regarded as sissy stuff in Washington. And the third thing we haven't talked about today, but we have to learn to do, is to shape ideas overseas. We're terrible at it. We invest almost nothing in it. In the background, why are the Islamists and the radicals making headway in Somalia? It's because the al-Qaeda narrative is widely believed in Somalia. It makes sense to people. This
Islam under attack. Let's band together and push back.
Exactly. There's a one-way war that's been going on for 100 years. The West is out to destroy Islam, so on and so forth. The narrative is 80% untrue, but we do nothing to fight against
John Pendergast, we've got 20 seconds. Has the bell been rung in Washington on this one? Is there going to be a change of policy as a result of what's just happened in Somalia?
I don't think so. I think Stephen's absolutely right. We've got to build the capacity to make peace and to build states, and we're not doing it. And they still want to do it on the cheap. They still want to throw the military at it instead of the political. And I fear for the future of Somalia and many other places.
And there we are with a big cry from the Horn of Africa. John Pendergast with the International Crisis Group. It's been great having you this hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Stephen Van Evere, political science professor at MIT, member of the MIT Security Studies Program. Steve, always great to see you.
Great to see you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.